We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning, and welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be looking at America's new national health law, the Affordable Care Act, and the guide for our conversation this morning is John McDonough. He is professor of the practice of public health and is also director of the Center for Public Health Leadership at the Harvard School of Public Health. He is a health policy expert and has done a number of things in the past, including having served as an advisor for the late Senator Edward Kennedy. We'll be talking about some of what it took to bring this legislation into law and also talk about perhaps some of the policies and some of the controversies embedded in this law. And you can find out more on this subject. And if you'd like to do some more reading, you might want to take a look at a book that our guest has authored. The title of his book is Inside National Health Reform. The publisher is the University of California Press. And certainly that's something that you should be able to find in the bookstore or the library if you are inclined. And as we talk, questions here on the program are welcome. 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And also, if you'd like to send an email, you can do that too, and the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, certainly people who are listening can participate. We ask people if they can, just to try to be brief, but we ask that so we can keep things moving along. And again, people want to call, you can do that. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. And Professor McDonough, hello.
Hello there.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I certainly appreciate it. And, I think one of the reasons I thought it would be good to have the conversation was to try to for people who aren't really quite sure what exactly is involved in the what is technically known as the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, it would be good to do a little review. But also, I suppose that the caveat here is we're talking about how things stand right now. And I think you try to make the point in the book that you're expecting that over time there will be changes, it will be tweaked so that the act as it exists today, if we were doing this show 10 years or 15 years from now, we could be talking about something different.
Absolutely. No law is written in stone. It is subject to change and alteration over time, and far more frequently than the public generally appreciates. There are always a broad community of interest who are deeply involved in the day-to-day back and forth on a law who are paying attention, and only a small proportion of the issues that get addressed break into the broader public awareness. One of the strange situations in terms of the Affordable Care Act is because of the contentiousness in the politics surrounding the law, both the passage of the law and now the implementation of the law, so many changes that would make sense and that would be normal in terms of how federal laws get passed and then changed over time are so difficult because of the charged atmosphere. There's a saying that, when people get along and can agree with each other, some of the most difficult things can be done with ease. And when people fundamentally don't like each other and can't work together, the simplest things can be impossible. And I think that really holds up in terms of the story of trying to make this law as effective as possible to improve health care for all Americans. Mm.
Something else that I know that you're trying to do in the book is to provide people with a little bit of an historical perspective on the health reform effort. And I think that people will, if you say, well, you're going to talk a little bit about the history of health reform, people, I think, probably will only go far in their memories. They're only going to go back to the Clinton administration. They're going to say, well, that's
right.
Really where this started. And I think that you make the point here that, in fact, that Barack Obama was the eighth president to undertake a serious effort, and I'm quoting here, to achieve some form of comprehensive national health reform, and that of these presidents, the only one who actually did it, who actually managed to be successful, was Lyndon Johnson. And there what we're talking about is Medicare and Medicaid.
That's correct. So we have really in U.S. history in the last 100 years, three landmark laws in terms of social welfare policy in the United States, particularly around health care, but beyond: the Social Security Act of 1935, the law creating Medicare and Medicaid in 1965, and then the Affordable Care Act in 2010. This is not something that happens every session of Congress, every decade, even every generation. This is a law of a magnitude, scope, and breadth that happens just about every third generation. And it really needs to be understood at that. And this is a very, very ambitious, and in terms of its length and its complexity, people complain about how long and how complex it is. But in attempting to reform a very complex and hard-to-penetrate healthcare system, that's why the law had to be big and complicated, because healthcare is so big and complicated now in the United States that the vast majority of Americans have a very hard time understanding or comprehending the system beyond their own immediate needs and issues.
Mm-hmm. Now, this has only been in effect now for a short time.
We're coming up on about 18 months.
About 18 months. So I guess, if you look back, I'm wondering, if you look back to the early years of Social Security or the early years of Medicare and Medicaid, and look at how people thought about that, what sort of, and then you say, okay, well, now here we are not much more than a year into this. Should we be really surprised that it's controversial, that people are unhappy with it, that people are saying that we never should have passed this and so forth? I mean, did it take a while for people to kind of come around on those other big federal programs?
Well, yes, it did. And in the 1930s with Social Security, after it passed, there was lots of opposition. There were people calling for repeal. And there was disagreement in Congress that the law wasn't good enough and didn't go far enough. And so before the law actually took effect in the early 1940s, Congress passed the first set of revisions to the Social Security Act in 1939, just 4 years after it had passed. Medicare, when it was created in 1965, there were a host of problems. The law required the desegregation for the very first time of all acute care hospitals in the United States, including in the Deep South. People were very wary and concerned about the social impact of rapid desegregation. There was also an attempted much discussed boycott by the American Medical Association of the new Medicare law. So these big laws bring with them big controversies that go beyond the signing of the law into effect, but go very deeply into the whole implementation process. And indeed, once these laws are set up, it's not like there's an endpoint then and you're done. We're still involved in discussing Social Security every year, every week in Congress. We're still involved in major changes to Medicare and Medicaid, even though the law was passed back in 1965. And it will be similar with the Affordable Care Act if it is implemented. And of course, there's a question mark on that. A lot of it has already been implemented. A lot of it is in process. There's a lot still to come. And there are some not just big policy implementation challenges. There are some major political challenges ahead. And there is a sharp disagreement within the country, as most people understand, about the law. And this sharp disagreement leads my colleague at the Harvard School of Public Health, Bob Blendon, to suggest that really the fate of the Affordable Care Act and its future is going to come down to one day, and that day is going to be November 6th, 2012. Mm. If that is a good day for Democrats, then chances are the law will be implemented largely intact with some changes. If that is a very good day for Republicans, chances are the major portions of that law in terms of expanding affordable insurance coverage to over 30 million Americans will more than likely be repealed and never take effect. So the day of consequence coming up is about 15 months from now.
Yeah. Well, I certainly want to talk about that, and particularly some of the questions revolving around the what is called the commonly called the individual mandate. That is that people are required to have health insurance. But before doing that, just again, just to stay with the history for just a little bit, I imagine that some people would, you know, looking at the fact that now a number of presidents had tried to do health reform, and certainly prior to President Clinton did, and one might think that if this was going to happen at any time, it might have been likely to happen at times when large entitlement programs were put into place. So you'd think, well, if it was going to happen at all, it would have happened either under Franklin Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson. And now, of course, a lot of big things did happen. Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid did. Why, though, prior to that, say before the Clinton administration, why is it, is there some reason you could say, well, that was really why up until Barack Obama, it didn't happen?
Well, because we've learned a lot over 100 years in terms of just how difficult it was to do. Franklin Roosevelt seriously considered including some kind of universal health care program in the Social Security Act, and the opposition from the American Medical Association scared him off, and he walked away and set up Social Security, and then looked in the 1940s toward moving toward national health insurance, and his death ended his involvement. But Harry Truman picked it up and tried it in the late 1940s and again faced a huge phalanx of opposition from organized medicine and was unsuccessful. Lots of people thought when Lyndon Johnson signed Medicare and Medicaid in 1965 that it would be followed within a very few number of years by an expansion of that model to the rest of the country. And indeed, Richard Nixon in the early 1970s, a Republican, made a very serious effort to create a universal health care structure. He deviated from the public coverage embodied in Medicare and Medicaid and wanted to create a national mandate on all employers to buy health insurance and all individuals to buy health insurance as well. And his efforts fell apart in the whole Watergate crisis, the political scandal that brought down his presidency, and that ended that effort. But so there have been many. But so one of the interesting things, and I saw this repeatedly when I was down in Washington, D.C. between 2008 and 2010, is that there was a very serious effort leading up to this political process to learn some of the important lessons from the political failures of the prior efforts. So there was an understanding, learning from, say, the Clinton example, that it was important to let Congress do the major amount of writing of the actual law. There was a recognition that it was important to move fast in an administration to have a chance to get it done. And those lessons were repeated among members, senators, and representatives. They were internalized by the staff people in the House and the Senate. They were internalized by folks in the Obama administration. So there was a lot of learning from prior history so that when we undertook it in early 2009, we wouldn't repeat 100 years of failures that had preceded this effort.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is John McDonough. He is professor of the practice of public health at the Harvard School of Public Health. As he just mentioned, between 2008 and 2010, he was in Washington. He served as a senior advisor on national health reform to the U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. Then before that, he served as executive director of Healthcare for All Massachusetts, a leading consumer health advocacy organization where he was very much involved in the passage and implementation of the 2006 Massachusetts Health Reform Law. Which we will talk about here. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have email as well. You can write us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's somebody who has a question on a cell phone here, line number one. Hello. Your caller there, line one. Well, perhaps that person changed their mind. In any case, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Perhaps just again, you could talk a little bit about the effort that was the health care reform effort that was waged under the Clinton administration, and particularly why it was that that was not successful?
Well, so in very early in the presidency of Bill Clinton, there was an effort to try to do national health reform. Bill Clinton ran for president in 1992 saying he was going to do this. And rather than moving quickly in January with legislation and pushing it forward, he appointed his wife, the First Lady Hillary Clinton, to head up a 500-person task force to try to figure out what the policy should be. And that ended up dragging out the process until late 1993. And by late 1993, the Clinton administration was already mired in a number of political controversies. They were getting increasingly attacked from many, many different quarters. And the momentum for reform faded significantly over those intervening 11 months. And so by the time the measure actually got before Congress in late 1993, a lot of the momentum had already evaporated. The economy was improving, and a lot of folks were getting health insurance again who had lost it in that economic downturn. And so that was an example of one of the critical lessons that folks in 2009 learned, was that if you want to make this happen, you can't sit on your hands and spend a lot of time wondering what the policy is going to be. You've got to get the congressional process moving as quickly as possible, which is why the committee on which I worked in the U.S. Senate, the late Senator Kennedy's help committee, started the first markup process in June of 2009. And by September, 4 months later, all five of the committees in the House and the Senate had held their what's known as their markup sessions, where they review their legislation and then move it forward. So the notion that if you're going to do it, you better try it early and fast rather than taking your time was very much a vitally important lesson that was learned from the Clinton failure in 93-94.
Mm. As I mentioned just a moment ago, you were involved in this organization in Massachusetts that where you were very much a part of this passage and implementation of the health reform there in 2006, which is, and I'm sure that this is something that we will be hearing more about, particularly if Mitt Romney, the former governor, ends up being the Republican nominee. I was very struck by the fact that just yesterday he gave a speech where he said if he was elected president, one of the first things that he would do would be to dismantle the act that we're talking about. I think, and some people have said, well, that's kind of odd, as it is very much like the one that he actually signed in 2006 when he was the governor of Massachusetts. So can you talk about the Massachusetts health reform, and what are there any connections, or at least can you say, well, that's what we now have here on the federal level is really very much like what it was that went into effect in Massachusetts in 2006?
Right. So one thing that's important to understand is that the Affordable Care Act is a huge statute, a huge law with many, many different pieces. It's got, you know, like a book has titles and a baseball game has innings, a federal law has titles. And the Affordable Care Act has 10 titles. And Title I deals with private health insurance in the United States. And the basic conceptual model of Title I is drawn from the Massachusetts health reform law that passed in 2006 and that then Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney signed. The rest of the 9 titles of the law have almost nothing to do with what Massachusetts health reform did. So there's a strong resemblance, but only for a small part. And the conceptual model of Massachusetts health reform that's reflected in the private health insurance parts of the Affordable Care Act has 3 parts. First is deep insurance market reform, mostly eliminating what's known as medical underwriting and imposing pre-existing condition requirements where insurance companies will cover you or not cover you only after they know everything about your medical history. In Massachusetts and beginning in 2014 across the United States, medical underwriting and imposing pre-existing condition requirements will be illegal in all health insurance markets. So that's a central innovation. The second innovation then is a requirement on individuals to purchase health insurance or else to pay a penalty for not having health insurance. And that's been law in Massachusetts since 2007. And that is also reflected in Title I and will take effect in 2014. Now, the problem with an individual mandate is, of course, is if you're going to mandate, you have to make insurance affordable. And that leads to the third essential component, the third leg of the three-legged stool, which is subsidies to help make insurance affordable for Americans who are going to be mandated to buy it, both making premiums affordable and providing protections in terms of not having onerous cost sharing imposed on individuals. So that's the three-legged stool: insurance reform, an individual mandate, and subsidies to make insurance affordable. That's the heart and soul of what Massachusetts did in 2006. It has brought the level of uninsurance in Massachusetts from over 8% to under 2%. We now have less than 1% of all children in the state who don't have health insurance. And that model is embedded in the Affordable Care Act. Now, Mitt Romney can say, yeah, I supported the three-legged stool, and he did, and he bragged about it. And when it was signed in 2006, he was talking about this as a national model. The sharp and strong political resistance to the law from Tea Party folks and from conservatives across the nation have made Mitt Romney kind of pull back from where he was in 2006, 7, and 8 to say that, yes, this was good for Massachusetts and I'm proud I did it, but it's only Massachusetts, and if another state wants to do it or something else, they should be able to. But as president, I don't want to impose my vision on all 50 states. That's a change in his position, and it has some policy legitimacy if that's how he wants to take it. But I think the question then is, what does happen to all of these folks around the country who are counting on getting health insurance? If you take the home state of Governor Romney's opponent, Rick Perry, in Texas right now, more than a third of adults under age 65, more than a third of adults have no health insurance at all. And then many, many others who do have health insurance have health insurance kind of in name only because they have huge deductibles and other cost sharing that's imposed on them. So there's a stark difference between Rick Perry and Mitt Romney that really is telling in terms of where we are as a nation and a society in providing basic health insurance security for everybody who lives in this country. Every other advanced country in the world, whether they do it through a government program or through the private market, has figured out how to cover all of their citizens to give them access to essential, life-important medical services and do it at either two-thirds or less the cost than we do it in the United States, with an increasing number of uninsured every year. So this is going to be, like it or not, a very, very compelling issue, not just in the general election in the fall of 2012, but very, very much in the Republican primary. And it's ironic that the state with the lowest rate of uninsurance, Massachusetts, is going to be pitted up against the state with the highest rate of uninsurance, namely Texas. And it's going to be a very interesting conversation for the American public, I believe.
All right. We'll go to the phones again for another caller. We have somebody here where we are, Champaign County. We'll go there. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. I come at it from the other direction, and that is I'm struck by the irony that the Ryan plan for so-called saving Medicare and Medicaid is a voucher market-based plan that basically works the same way as what the Obama plan would do for the uninsured. So once you sort of let the camel's nose under the tent and you're advocating that system, it's kind of easy for them to come back and say, well, you want it for the uninsured, why don't we just do it for everybody or something? I guess that's the concept. But and I think it's flawed. And there's a broad scope here. You mentioned, you know, the early days. Truman also was trying to offer a continuation of the Social Security vision, which would have been a sort of a single-payer plan. There was a lot of activism in the interim that isn't commented on much. The Hill-Burton Act allowed community people and the Champaign County healthcare consumers actually get their name from the committees that were established to actually try to have some kind of social control over, you know, what kind of hospital beds are offered and how many CAT scans and MRIs would be supportable by the community and have input. So I'm just saying there wasn't, you know, absolutely nothing going on, but there were sort of reformist things like that. What I'm struck by is another uncommon aspect of the Health America Act, which was the real name of the Clinton plan, was Senator Simon, our favorite son, his improvements to the Health America Act, which, you know, he just proposed and didn't even get a co-sponsor in the Senate. And I think he died fairly soon after that. But one of his clauses was that to allow states to have an option for a single-payer plan, which Vermont would be happy to have in any plan because they're going ahead with it. Actually, in California, it was passed twice when they knew it would be vetoed by the governor, and I haven't heard any more activism actually talking about doing it. I think everybody's preoccupied with health exchanges instead, I'm afraid. So, and Illinois has had a robust single-payer movement, including our governor, who marched across the state in support of a single-payer plan, but we also don't hear it. And you know, it really is a solution to the high cost of medical care. It's not, you know, Medicare is not flawed. It's the health delivery system itself that's flawed because it includes a lot of paper shufflers who contribute nothing to the health of the people that they're contracted with. They basically make money by delaying payments, and that's what insurance companies do generally. So that's a long screed, and I'm happy to have the opportunity to hear your reactions to it, and hope other people will consider the scope of this.
All right. Well, go ahead, Professor McDonough.
Wow. Well, thank you. There's so much there. That's a very rich question. So, and a lot of really terrific points. And I talk in my book a fair amount about the role of the single payer option and movement in its involvement in the process leading to the passage of the Affordable Care Act. And there was a very strong, in the House of Representatives, single-payer caucus of about 80 members, not close to a majority, and nothing to sneeze at either. There was no way, even under Nancy Pelosi, a single-payer plan would have had the votes to pass the House. In the Senate, we tried to count the number of senators who might vote for a single-payer. And in the best of all circumstances, we could never get out of single digits. So the challenge was not could someone dream up what is the ideal plan, and I frankly would prefer single payer to any other model myself, but it was simply not feasible. And so if we were going to pass something to try and improve healthcare for all Americans, it wasn't going to be single payer. Now, one of the things that Vermont is learning as Vermont explores setting up its own single payer by 2017 is that there's a lot in the Affordable Care Act that makes doing a single payer much more feasible than if the Affordable Care Act doesn't exist. So I think it's worth keeping that in mind. And just the first point that you made about the resemblance between Wisconsin Representative Paul Ryan's plan for reform of Medicare and its resemblance to the Affordable Care Act, there were some really strong elements of truth there, because we're looking at a plan that basically gives people access to private health insurance as opposed to a traditional Medicare, which is direct access to public coverage paid directly by the government. There's an important difference, though. What Paul Ryan's plan does is it puts some severe, strict limits on how much the government will pay, so that right now, if you are in Medicare, whatever part of Medicare you're in, generally speaking, the federal government pays about 70% of the cost of your care. And you as an individual, whether through premiums or co-payments or deductibles or whatever, end up paying about 30% on average. And it varies across the board. Under Paul Ryan's plan, within a very few short years, in general, the federal government would be paying about 30% of the cost of your care, and the federal government would be paying, the federal government would pay 30%, and individuals would pay 70%. So it is a radical shift in terms of the financial exposure of seniors and disabled folks who count on Medicare. And that is one of the most disturbing elements of that plan, and that resembles in no way, shape, or form the structure envisioned under the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare as it's otherwise known.
We have another caller here. We'll get to it right in a moment, and we'll continue to talk with our guest, John McDonough, from the Harvard School of Public Health. We're talking about health reform in America. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, three firefighters tell their 9/11 stories. Jay Jonas was on the fourth floor of the World Trade Center's North Tower when it collapsed around him. Ken Haskell lost two brothers who were also firefighters. Retired firefighter Dennis Smith collects their stories and others in his new book, Decade of Hope. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 to noon with 10 different topics. Tomorrow morning in our 10 o'clock hour, we will be talking about the attacks of 9/11. Our guest will be Lawrence Wright. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and won the Pulitzer Prize in 2007 for his book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, which is now out in paperback. Then Friday morning at 10, we will talk about the future of the U.S. space program. And the guest there will be Louis Friedman. He's an aeronautics engineer and is the executive director emeritus of the Planetary Society. As I said, we have 10 topics for you every week. You can check the schedule by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. You can also sign up there for a podcast or go to our web archive and listen to some past programs that you might have missed first time around. In this hour of Focus, our guest is John McDonough. He is a professor of the practice of public health, is also director of the Center for Public Health Leadership at the Harvard School of Public Health. He also has served, this was between 2008 and 2010, served as senior advisor on national health reform to the U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. He also was involved as executive director of Health Care for All Massachusetts. This was a consumer health advocacy organization that was very much involved in passing and implementing the 2006 Massachusetts health reform law. He also has served in the Massachusetts House of Representatives, where he co-chaired the Joint Committee on Health Care, and is author of a book that's titled Inside National Health Reform. It is published by the University of California Press. We have a caller here to go to next, someone in Coles County on our line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, you may have answered this before and I didn't hear it, but I just want your honest appraisal of how the Massachusetts law has worked, whether it's worked okay or not. Also, whether or not such a law would work in Illinois, which is a much bigger state. And number two, do you think that so-called Obamacare will ever actually go fully into effect in the next 2 or 3 years? That's all.
All right. Well, very good. I suppose, in, you know, I've mentioned here, perhaps in the interest of full disclosure, I think I mentioned that you were involved in implementing this, in passing and implementing it. So I would assume that you would think that the 2006 Massachusetts law was a good one.
Well, so thank the caller for really precise and well-formed questions. So first one is, has the Massachusetts health reform law worked? It depends upon the standards, but I like to judge laws by the standards they were set up to produce. And Massachusetts health reform was established to try to dramatically reduce the rate of uninsurance in Massachusetts. And it succeeded dramatically well in doing that, from an uninsurance rate of over 8% to now under 2%, and pretty much holding there. And lots of folks afraid that under this structure, employers would stop offering health insurance and tell their workers to go on to the public plan. That hasn't happened. Massachusetts is, I believe, the only state in the nation where the percentage of employers actually offering coverage to their workers has gone up over the past 5 years. So, striking success. It did not provide a solution to controlling rising health care and health insurance costs. It was never structured to do that. Some folks like Mitt Romney bragged that it would. Those were really some ill-informed comments. But the purpose for which it was set up, it has succeeded well. Can it work in Illinois and in other states, particularly much larger states? Sure it can. It works as a model in many other countries. We've provided a demonstration that you can make it work. It is not easy. It is not simple. It requires a lot of effort. But, you know, when we started this process in Massachusetts, over 90% of the public already had health insurance. And if you ask those 90%, have they seen big changes because of the Massachusetts health reform law, their answer would be really no. The people who have seen the results are people who get access to coverage and who needed it before because they didn't have health insurance. So it has worked in Massachusetts on the terms it was set up. It can work, although it's not going to be something that's going to be a smooth ride. There will be disruptions, and there'll be people who will be unhappy because of some changes in how the markets work. But it can work. And will Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act go into effect? I think first of all, a lot of it has already gone into effect. So, for example, right now it is illegal for insurance companies to sell you a health insurance policy that has a lifetime or an annual limit on how much it will cover in terms of medical benefits. The annual limits are phasing out between now and 2014. Lifetime limits are now illegal. Companies are now required, insurance companies, to make sure that they pay at least 80 or 85% of your premium dollar on medical services. There are about 30 other important changes that have already taken effect over the past 18 months that, were they done just unto themselves, people would have said, wow, those are really significant and important. With this act, the biggest stuff is still to come in 2014, the individual mandate, the subsidies, and the insurance market reform guaranteed issue for all Americans. And really, as I mentioned before, the fate of the law, whether it's going to go into effect as fully realized, will really be determined on November 6th, 2012. The next federal elections in terms of who controls the White House, the U.S. Senate, and the U.S. House of Representatives, more than anything will tell. If Democrats control all three branches, expect it to be implemented largely as designed. If Republicans control all three branches, expect the major parts of the law to be repealed. And if we have divided government, as we have right now, expect a kind of a jump ball in terms of how it's going to go, and it's going to be contentious and hard.
It seems that the most, well, it seems, the, I was going to say the most contentious thing, maybe among the, there are a number of things that are contentious, but the most contentious thing is the individual mandate. And that is the thing that, where there have been challenges, there have been a number of court challenges, and there are some people who are arguing essentially that the requirement that people have health insurance is unconstitutional. And I think the expectation is that it's something that's going to have to be resolved by the United States Supreme Court. And that's maybe, again, another consideration apart from who it is controls Congress and who is in the White House.
Well, yes. And so it is entirely likely that this issue will end up in the Supreme Court. It may very well end up there next year in 2012, and we'll have a ruling sometime next spring, or it could tip into 2013. We're not entirely sure, but we should know that fairly soon. And again, even if the court were to rule against the individual mandate at this point, the lawsuits affecting all the other parts of the law are not touched by the remaining elements of the suit. So the mandate could go down, and the rest of the law could be implemented without the mandate. The difficulty is with the individual mandate, and the reason why it's there is because if you have a requirement that insurers essentially have to insure everybody who comes through their doors and can't, excuse me, check on whether you had cancer or whether you had a heart disease or whether you've been to see a psychiatrist and refused to cover you, that will be illegal. When you set up that system known as guaranteed issue, if you don't have an individual mandate, there are a significant number of individuals out there who will wait until they think they're going to be sick or need medical services before they buy health insurance. And when enough people do that, that tends to then raise the price of health insurance for everybody else. So the purpose of the individual mandate is to create a system that recognizes that we're all in this together. Now, if the Supreme Court strikes down the individual mandate, and let's say Democrats take the House and the Senate and the White House in 2012, they could reinstitute it and end all this controversy if they went into Title I of the Affordable Care Act and simply changed one word. Right now, the individual mandate, even though it is a penalty that is administered by the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, it is referred to as a penalty and not a tax. If Congress went back and added one word, either changed tax for penalty or just added the word tax penalty, there is absolutely no doubt, according to any constitutional scholar, that it would be entirely legitimate and constitutional for Congress and the President to do this. So you could expect, if it's struck down, that Congress may come back in January 2013 through what's known as a Budget Reconciliation Act, which only requires 51 votes in the Senate, and make that change, and then implement it largely as designed with the change of that one tiny word.
We have some other callers here. We'll get them in right now. We'll go first to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
I was just reading the reform act, the one they've already demonized as the Obamacare, and I was just looking at it. It says there will be an increase of 32 million uninsured. When you read some analysis of those, some people say that the number won't be, the number would be, or the number would be higher. Do we think the healthcare system that we have today would be able to afford all those new people who be covered in the system?
So the Congressional Budget Office, which is the nonpartisan budget overseer of Congress in terms of the fiscal impact of laws and proposed laws, has estimated that if fully implemented by 2018, the Affordable Care Act will cover about 32 million Americans who today don't have health insurance coverage. They also estimate that this law, the Affordable Care Act, if implemented as it was written, over a 10-year period, would actually reduce the federal budget deficit by about $74 billion. How is that possible? That's possible because in addition to starting these new programs, which will spend money to cover people, Congress also included in the law changes to the Medicare program to reduce its rate of growth by about $500 billion over 10 years, and included a set of new revenue increases, particularly on high-income earners, folks making over $250,000 a year. So it is a law that is paid for, and I'd contrast that, by the way, it's worth contrasting with the 2003 law that was passed by Congress when President Bush was in charge and the Republicans ran the Senate and the House. They passed a law that year creating for the first time an outpatient prescription drug program in Medicare known as Part D. And that law, they chose not to pay for any of it. So over the next 10 years, the Affordable Care Act will actually, if implemented as designed, lower the federal deficit by over $70 billion. And the Part D program is projected over the next 10 years to increase the federal deficit by about $1 trillion. So, yes, we can afford to do these things if there is the will on the part of Congress to pay for them. There was the will to pay for the Affordable Care Act. We'll see if it's implemented. There was not political will to pay for the prescription drug program in Medicare in 2003, and that is one of many reasons why we're in this very difficult budget situation right now.
I want to thank the caller. We have just about 7-8 minutes left. I have someone else I want to get on to, and just let me introduce once again the guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. John McDonough is with us. He's professor of the practice of public health and also director of the Center for Public Health Leadership at the Harvard School of Public Health, and is author of the book Inside National Health Reform. It is published by the University of California Press. We'll go on to another caller here. This is someone in Vermilion County on our line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello. I'm glad to have you on. I heard you say something about counting up senators who might vote for a single-payer plan, and I remember back when this was all being discussed on some poll or other, or they were repeating the, you know, taking polls and showing us the results, that the general population of voters wanted this single-payer outcome to the tune of maybe 80-some percent. It was a favorable response to that sort of a question thing, would you rather have a single-payer? So I wonder if you could describe how does this overwhelming desire from the voters for a single-payer get a negative response in the elected officials? I have to hang up because I'm now driving. So I'll thank you in advance.
Okay. And thank you for the call.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. So, you know, let me just put the context. I'm somebody who is enormously sympathetic to the intellectual policy case for single payer as a smarter way to do our health system than the way we do it. In fact, there's a lot of ways to do our health system better than we do it right now in terms of getting better value for the money we invest as a society in healthcare services. That being said, there are a lot of different surveys in terms of the sentiments of America in support or non-support for single payer. And some of the surveys that I rely on most are from my colleague Bob Blendon at the Harvard School of Public Health, who does it with the Kaiser Family Foundation and the Washington Post, generally finds that the proportion of Americans who would like to have a totally government-run healthcare system is somewhere between 35 and 45%. It is not a majority. It's a large number. It's a significant plurality of the American public, and it doesn't at all get up to the 80% range. There are some polls showing it in the upper 50 or low 60%. But so clearly, though, there is non-support within the vast majority of the United States Senate for moving the nation to a single-payer system. And had Senator Kennedy and the other leaders of the Senate put a single-payer plan on the floor of the Senate with the backing of President Obama and whomever, it would have gone down to a crushing defeat. And rather than all of these changes, which don't improve the system as much as I or many Americans like the caller would like, does in fact move us significantly further in terms of creating a fairer and more just healthcare system in the United States. But there simply were not the votes, and had we done it and had we stuck with that, we would have ended up with absolutely nothing. And an awful lot of people who are getting help now and will be getting help in the years ahead would be out of luck.
All right. Again, we'll get one more, at least one more caller here. This is Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to point out one thing. The claim is, of course, that we can't afford universal health care. And the right is adamant about this. But the truth is, it's more expensive not to have universal health care. Because these people that are denied long-term health care end up in the emergency room. Someone pays far more for that kind of treatment, which is much less effective. And it comes out of the public pocket in the end anyway. Am I right in saying this?
Well, we would like to think that. And we certainly have made that case that getting everybody covered will create efficiencies, make sure that people get better care before conditions become too acute. But in this case, Massachusetts is kind of an example for the nation, and it's not an example that backs up your argument. There has been really little or no decline in emergency room use in Massachusetts since the implementation of Massachusetts health reform, in spite of lots of people's hopes and predictions, including former Governor Romney, that it would. And that's because the truth is a very, very large proportion of people actually using those emergency rooms, you know, and maybe more so in a state like Massachusetts, which started with a much higher base of coverage than other states, but so a very large majority of the folks using those emergency rooms already have coverage. So we would like to think there are some improvements. Massachusetts, as the canary in the coal mine that's gone down this path of getting to very near universal coverage, we have not seen those drops. So I can't sit here and tell you, yes, you can count on that going to happen, because it might, the experience might be different in other states where you have a much higher rate of uninsurance, like Texas, where over a third of adults don't have any health insurance at all. But the evidence on that is still, I think, in dispute.
We're just about out of time. We have about a minute. We have talked about, spent a lot of time talking about the individual mandate, which has got a lot of attention. You also mentioned some of the consumer protection aspects of the act, and it is long and complicated. I guess I just wonder whether you think, is there something that you would think that people really should know about it that hasn't gotten the attention that it should?
Well, this is the reason I wrote this book. I do a lot of talking around the country to all kinds of audiences, for and against, regular public and medical professionals, and I find overwhelmingly a huge amount of confusion and non-familiarity with the Affordable Care Act as a law, what it does, what makes it tick, why it is the way it is. And so that's why I really wrote this law. I mean, it's a little higher than Health Reform 101 or Health Reform for Dummies, but it's not health reform, it's not the Affordable Care Act for PhDs or folks who know a lot. This is for folks who've heard about this issue, are concerned, want to know more, and as a starting point, because the fate of the law is going to hold in the balance over the next 15 months, provide a way for people to really get their arms around the Affordable Care Act as a law itself. And so I think that's really the major part, is people need to understand the architecture of this law, the logic, how it's structured, the money flows. And that's what I try to provide in Inside National Health Reform.
All right. Well, that's the book to look for, Inside National Health Reform. It is published by the University of California Press by our guest, John McDonough. He is professor of the practice of public health at the Harvard School of Public Health. And we want to thank you very much, Professor McDonough, for giving us your time. We also want to say thanks to the folks at the Brenneman Women's Hospital in Boston, from which he is speaking, and also to Kristen Harbless and Kevin Fuller, the coordinating technical people there for Boston Bureau Productions, helping to provide us with this high-quality connection. And again, Professor McDonough, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. He wrote this law. I mean, it's a little higher than Health Reform 101 or Health Reform for Dummies, but it's not health reform. It's not the Affordable Care Act for PhDs or folks who know a lot. This is for folks who've heard about this issue, are concerned, want to know more, and as a starting point, because the fate of the law is going to hold in the balance over the next 15 months, provide a way for people to really get their arms around the Affordable Care Act as a law itself. And so I think that's really the major part, is people need to understand the architecture of this law, the logic, how it's structured, the money flows, and that's what I try to provide in Inside National Health Reform.
All right. Well, that's the book to look for, Inside National Health Reform. It is published by the University of California Press by our guest, John McDonough. He is professor of the practice of public health at the Harvard School of Public Health. And we want to thank you very much, Professor McDonough, for giving us your time. We also want to say thanks to the folks at the Brenneman Women's Hospital in Boston, from which he is speaking, and also to Kristen Harbless and Kevin Fuller, the coordinating technical people there for Boston Bureau Productions, helping to provide us with this high-quality connection. And again, Professor McDonough, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
And that's it for us on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. More news features coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thanks, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. In Kansas City, September wheat trading at 843 1/4, down 2 3/4. The December contract down 3 at 862 1/2. September wheat Chicago, 715 1/4, down 1. December 755, down 5. September corn, 743 3/4, down 3. December 754 1/4, down 1 1/2. March 767, down 1 1/4. May 773 3/4, down 1 1/4. September soybeans, 1409, down 4 1/2. November 1417, down 4 3/4. January 1428 3/4, down 3 1/2. March 1433 3/4, down 2 1/2.